This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Coming on the train here, I realized that I was trying to trace back my intention when I began making this film. It took a long, long time because it required the project begun in 1987 and right after the death of my father. I was in New York and I traveled to Argentina when I heard that he had died, and by the time I arrived there, my family had already buried him. I'm not making a comparison between my father and Che Guevara. The only thing that makes me think of the moment is that in the Jewish families, the children are never allowed to see the dead. And so I remember that when my grandparents died, that the little ones were never allowed to see them. I have never seen a dead person right in front of me. In the house, the mirrors will be covered with sheets. There was a whole very strong tradition of not showing the dead to children. So I realized that the only image of a human cadaver that I had in my mind was the image of Che Guevara. This was in 1987, 20 years after the murder of Che Guevara, and I was in Buenos Aires, and I began seeing posters from political organizations that were somehow celebrating or paying homage to the 20-year anniversary, and that is how the idea came about. I remember this iconic photograph. I came back to New York and went to the Bethmann archives, and I began looking through the archives, and I found this Reuter photograph. As I explained in the film, I began at that point seeing that the credit was given to an archivist, an editor at UPI Reuter. I tried to contact him in Washington. Reuter had already been dismembered. All the archives had been sold to different photo archives. And I had great difficulty finding this person. It took me nearly a year of trying to contact this journalist whose name was actually as a credit in the photograph that I had bought from the photo agency. When I finally spoke with him, he was in Panama during the Noriega days, and he told me, I'm not the photographer. I was credited for the photograph, but the photographer is anonymous. I don't even remember his name. Was a Bolivian stringer who would be as a contact. The stringer is placed by the news agencies, or it used to be placed by the news agencies as a liaison, as a contact. And this man suggested that I call all the newspapers in Bolivia from New York, and I began doing that, and this is how I finally got in touch with Freddy Alborta, who you see in El Día Que Me Quieras, in the film. Freddy died last year. I met him in already in 1990, and that is when I had already begun doing the research. In those days, there was no internet. You had to do the research by foot, by hand. You know, as you had to go to newspaper libraries in different countries. Remember that the 80s were. There was a period in which, for example, the Argentine press could not publish any type of tendentious in 1967, 1970, any kind of tendentious information. The press was dominated by the military, who were in power at that time, so the Argentine press didn't have any information about the death of Che Guevara in 1967. So the way I would work is I would come back to New York and go to the New York Public Library and began doing research there. It was very ironic because Latin American historians would say the best place to do research would be in the libraries. The interesting thing about the New York Public Library was that all the microfilm archives of all the Latin American newspapers were very, very scratched, very damaged. So I would go to a small branch of the New York Public Library in Brooklyn and find impeccable microfilms that I began using for the preliminary research. The research took a long, long time. The film was released finally 10 years later in 1997 for the 30th anniversary of the death of Guevara. And when I began, as I said, doing this film, I thought I would have to interview a journalist, a photojournalist in Washington at the Reuters UPI headquarters. When I realized that I had to go to Bolivia, and I finally managed to make contact with Freddy Alborta, I spoke with him briefly on the telephone, and this very modest voice said, "Yes, sir, it's me. I was the one that took the photographs, and I have many more." And so I got on a plane, went to Bolivia, met Freddy Alborta. We became really good friends. And then I came back with a crew and filmed the interview and began the whole process of putting together El Día Que Me Quieras. I wanted to do an interview, but I didn't want to do a journalistic interview. I didn't want to just have a talking head. I wanted to make a work of art. And somehow I think I have succeeded because the film continues to play. There are many, many other films on Che Guevara, many documentaries for some reason, because I managed to incorporate a kind of subjective energy into the film and cross it with the journalistic information. The film has a different dimension. Usually the documentary informational film becomes a sort of disposable, a disposable medium. You know, it ages very quickly, and you know, the material that you work with as a documentarian becomes dated. And so I wanted to avoid making something that was very dated. I want to show you a number of things that I did around the film, because one of the nature of research, especially in a historical on a historical event that is shrouded by mystery, that has been repressed, where the information has been repressed by dominating military cultures and governments, is very difficult, it's very fragmented, and it tends to expand in many, many different directions. In order to make a film, you have to contain the material. And so I decided that as an artist, I would make a film about the photograph by Freddy Alborta, contain it within that context of the photograph, and that all the research that I had done, which I would have liked to incorporate into the film, was really not proper. It would break, it was very dispersive, I couldn't use the material in that way. And so I began making gallery installations, and with the material from the research, I began using a new medium that I'm still using, which is the idea of the text mural. So I didn't want to publish a book with the information. I wanted the environment of the gallery, the communal environment of the gallery, to hold the information so that when you enter the gallery, you are entering a kind of mural book. And so I began making the installations. I'm still working in that format. I work on a specific documentary subjects that have to do with usually Latin American culture and Latin American politics. El Día que me quieras, The Day You Love Me, became, as an installation, the project for The Day You Love Me. And I love the name, the idea of having a project for The Day You Love Me, the idea that, you know, the Day You Love Me is the title of a tango, and the title of a tango that is about unrequited, you say? Unrequited love. So in a way it means something like, something that John Wayne would say, that would be the day. You know, it's like an unfulfilled promise, something that will not become true, a utopia. So to call the film El Día que me quieras was, you know, to suggest two things. First of all, that there was a relationship between the object and the subject in literary terms, meaning that who says El Día que me quieras? Is Che Guevara saying that to the audience, or is the audience saying that to Che Guevara, right? And so the idea of creating projects around that whole notion, the project for The Day You Love Me, became central, and I worked for several years using... this is the only section that has sound. And it's a luxury, Aaron, thank you. It's just a little bit of sound. So these are images on and about the day. And, well, if you just saw the film, you saw the comparison between the Rembrandt, the anatomy lesson of Dr. Taub and Freddy Alborta's photograph. The comparison was made by art historian and writer John Berger. It was so brilliant. It was made for a publication in 1968 was called The Minority of One. And the essay by John Berger is just so wonderful, so inspiring. That material, 20 years later, remained in my memory, and I began deconstructing this photograph, thinking that I would do a minor work, and yet I became involved with something very elaborate that lasted up until, you know, last year, 2007. I was still working on the ramifications of the film. The thing that attracted me and that made me want to speak with the photographer was this. And you see it briefly in the film. And it was the fact that I couldn't see his arm, and so there was an element of horror, you know. It's like, and I would question this whole idea of, am I going to aestheticize horror? Is this what I'm doing? And then I said, this is a banal preoccupation. I should go ahead because the content of this work is much more powerful than any consideration that I may have regarding my scruples about aestheticizing horror. I was horrified by the realization that I could not see the arm and I could see a forearm here. So that was the motor, you could say, the dynamo that began, that propelled me into wanting to speak with the photographer. I went to the site. I had done work where I would hold, on the Maya, where I would hold a photograph or an old engraving in front of something contemporary, what we saw on present time. And so I went to La Higuera, where Che Guevara's body was displayed, and I visited the area after interviewing for the first time Freddy Alborta. I went there and I took this photograph, carrying the Reuter, as you can see, the Reuter photo which was, you can see the credit to the editor, it's not even, Freddy Alborta's name is not even mentioned. I saw the enormous amount of graffiti in that laundry room, and I saw the laundry, the basin, the cement laundry basin where his cadaver was displayed, and I saw the dried flowers and took this photograph. These are some of the Freddy Alborta photographs that you can see in the film. I also began gathering documentation. This is a poster that circulated during the period of the guerrilla in Bolivia, where the military were running a demonizing campaign against the Che Guevara's guerrilleros. There was this anti-demonizing campaign comparing the guerrilleros with Christ. The poster says he dresses humbly, he's a worker, he's badly fed, he has foreign ideas, he associates with common people, with the unemployed. His alias is the Prince of Peace, the Light of the World, etc. His visible signs are beard, long hair, wounds in his hands and feet produced by respectable citizens directed by legal authorities. I'm showing you some of the Freddy Alborta photographs that you can also see in the film. The question of the arm is revealed. The question of whose forearm is also revealed, because we find out that there are other cadavers on the ground. And then the comparisons, the perspective comparisons with the paintings that John Berger makes, the Mantegna, the Rembrandt, are also associated. I want to show you also work done by fellow artists in Argentina who address at the time in 1968, the image of Che Guevara's cadaver. This is a painting by Antonio Berni. The similarity, there is a kind of similarity both to the women that surround the Mantegna, for example, the woman wiping his tears, her tears, and the women that we see here in the painting. This is another work by Berni, in which, you know, a TV set is central. There is a Freddy Alborta photograph, and it's surrounded by this caricaturesque skeletons representing the military. This is a work by Carlos Alonso. You cannot see the rest of the screen. And again, the images of the image and the associations with Rembrandt, in this case, with journalism, there are cameras, there are images that remind you of Rembrandt paintings. There are a number of elements. You see a passport with the fingerprint display that was captured by the military. This is another Carlos Alonso. Again, there is a reminiscence and a invocation of Rembrandt paintings and, you know, in his style, an incorporation of the Freddy Alborta photograph as an image. There's it's kind of interesting to see, and I noticed it for the first time, his pants are lower, and I'll show you something later that has to do with the treatment that the military gave to people when they were captured and killed. I want to show you, I make a transition here. When I was doing the work, I began finding myself with the results of research, and I began myself to do a series of photographic experiments in which I layer through layers of glass. I put objects at different focal points and then photograph them from above. And so it would be a kind of like, it would make reference to the work of the photographer, the artist, the objects that are iconic related to the film, to Borges, and to the images of Che Guevara that I had gathered for the film, all the graphic works. With all that material, I began doing graphic works such as these, where I incorporate either loops, magnifying glasses, the negatives from the photographs, the newspapers, a photographer's clip, and then letters loose on these layers of glass and film in different focal planes from above, making a kind of like three-dimensional kind of attempt to put things in different dimensions. Different objects, etc. I wonder if I will be able to change programs without Aaron's help. And then this is the last, and then we go to the other program to the first slide. Yes. Great, thank you. Oh, great, terrific. Okay, this is about the installations. These are all accumulative installations. I came up with this idea of making accumulative installations because the project was so big and the research was in progress. And so I decided every time I do an installation on the subject, I will show the first installation, and then when I do a second one, I will show the first and the second, and then the first, second, and third, and so forth. And there were many, many shows, and so they were accumulative. I will perfect the information, mainly. But this is a sample of the kind of work that I was doing. I was getting material, as I said, from libraries. I would travel to Bolivia to a provincial library where a devoted librarian would keep all the newspapers from the period. I would go to Mexico. I would go to Brooklyn. I had friends in Zurich. I had friends in Frankfurt who were doing research for me. I had friends in Russia. I went to Moscow to do research. I moved around a lot looking for material. As I said, many of the material from that period in the 1980s did not really exist. It's kind of extraordinary to go on the internet now and see the enormous amount of material that is out there on Che Guevara. When I was working in the late 80s, early 90s, there was nothing there, perhaps one page. 30 years after, in 1997, 30 years when the stature of limitation was over, State Department files were released. And this was very, very interesting because a lot of things, one could find out a lot of things, such as, for example, the fact that the CIA and the State Department knew exactly what Che Guevara was during the period of the guerrillas, 1967, and yet in order to create a whole kind of like panic in Bolivia and to sort of penetrate Bolivia with military aid and all that, both the Bolivian military created a situation in which they began spreading the news that the country was invaded by 500 Cubans who were conducting guerrilla warfare. And so they began bringing, you know, the infantry and the generals who had been active in Vietnam in order to counter the so-called insurrection. I would take. It's interesting how my graphics have resolved in clipped sections. I have to still learn how to use graphics in this presentation. So here you see the passport photograph that I had shown you, which I blew up from a very small reproduction in a book published by the military, and began making this large banners. This is a show at the Art Institute of Chicago, where I have several of the installations. Here is the passport photograph in a banner held by, stretched by turnbuckles and steel wire. This is a show, again, at the Chicago Art Institute. I was telling Osvaldo that I sort of invented the idea of plotting an image in small sections so that I could travel, because traveling to biennales and to exhibitions with large banners and large work was just so difficult. I decided to start plotting and laminating the fragmenting photographs and turning them and then assembling them on location. There's a photograph of Tania, who is the only woman that fought with Che Guevara. By the way, there is another film on display here at SLOT, which is called Exhumación. It's only in Spanish. It is a talking head with the anthropologist, the forensic anthropologist, who finally, in 1997, found the clandestine grave of Che Guevara and his companions in Bolivia. The interview is really marvelous. It was done last year, and in 2007, for the 40th anniversary, was shown in Buenos Aires. And then I introduce an element that that made me very, very curious, because of the success of the Cuban Revolution and the coverage that the Sierra Maestra had during the Cuban Revolution for Fidel Castro and for Che Guevara, mainly due to the visit of journalists who would come and photograph them and turn them into mythological figures. Che Guevara and his team would carry cameras and photograph each other and photograph the campaign, the camps, and they would take pictures of themselves. And then when they were captured, the military would use these pictures to identify them. Of course, the guerrilleros were so optimistic, they thought at the end of a successful campaign in Bolivia, they would make a big book and they would send it to the press and this and that. And there were 17 people. There were about four cameras with them. One of the cameras is Tania, as I said, the only woman who fought with Che. Here we see her taking photographs. The photographs were captured and they became trophies, war trophies. And the military began creating a market in recent years, especially. The military are still selling the photographs taken by the victims of the of their repression, of their, well, repression or struggle or however you would like to call it. They compared to the things that we watch on the news nowadays, daily, the loss of life on both sides during the 11 months campaign of Che Guevara in Bolivia was less than 100 men. And from both sides, soldiers and guerrilleros. The guerrilleros were 17. There were some deserters and volunteers who deserted and were captured or were captured and killed. There were casualties in the military, in the Bolivian military, but compared, not trying to put a value on the number, but compared to, you know, the things that we watch every day, 100 lives lost doesn't seem that much. But however, this whole the Che Guevara campaign has become a rather interesting narrative because of its implications, because of the period, because of the iconic figure of Che Guevara, and because of mysterious circumstances. I often think of Borges talking about the mystery of how the image of Che Guevara becomes so iconic. Borges speaks of referring to biblical figures, referring to his readings of the Bible, of the Talmud, referring to the Holy Spirit, referring to certain items that carry a significance, a religious significance. Jorge Luis Borges speaks of the professional secret of the object. And so what we have here with the iconic image of Guevara and the iconic image of all these pictures that we see is that it's not clear to understand the professional secret of the object. And I think it's an interesting concept. As you can see, I took the photograph of Tania La Guerrillera. I plotted it, laminated it, and then with little hooks, I make these banners that allow me to travel to foreign countries without having to carry, you know, large work and go through all sorts of custom requirements and all that. I also began plotting text. As you can see, this is an installation of plotted images. I begin to research the participation of a number of characters around Guevara. Tania is one of them. The other one is this man that we see on the side who had a nom de guerre, a nickname, Loro, which means parrot. And Loro Vasquez Viaña was captured by the military, and it was executed, and was the son of a Bolivian historian who disappeared. Here they photograph themselves. It's kind of like almost a humorous photograph, because Guevara is on a mule and he's looking like one of those statues of generals on horses, and they're posing there. And so I took the Loro and Che photograph, I plotted it, and then I explained the case of Loro in the plotted text, which was all the text that I use. Then I made an artist book, which, you know, by printing the sections of the plotted photograph, and it's a do-it-yourself installation. The book comes apart, and then you can paint the wall red, you get instructions, and then you can paste all the elements of this puzzle, this photograph. Another iconic image is the image of Monica Ertl. This is a real interesting case. A young woman. This was on the BBC very recently, when the father of this woman, Hans Ertl, died in Bolivia very recently. Hans Ertl was one of the cameramen of the film Olympia, by a film made by Hitler as a propaganda film. It's a beautiful film by Leni Riefenstahl. Even though it's a film of a particular persuasion, Nazi persuasion, that has to do with the Olympic Games of a particular year, the Olympic Games that take place in Berlin during the Nazi period, Leni Riefenstahl does. It's beyond discussion. That's a very beautiful film on the beauty of, you know, the human body, especially the Aryan race, right? And the cameraman that photographs Olympia, when the Allies occupy Germany, he flees to Bolivia with his daughter. His wife and daughter, the daughter is barely 10 years old. She grows up in a German-Bolivian community of exiles, some of them Jews and some of them Nazis. And she grows up and becomes a sympathizer of the Guevara movement. After Guevara is killed, this woman disguises herself and decides to take revenge on the men who had to do with the death of Guevara. In this case, the cadaver that you see right here, which is the body of the chief of the secret police in Bolivia, who at that point was given a title of German consul in Frankfurt, because Monica Ertl had both a Bolivian and a German passport. She decides to go to Frankfurt and to execute this man who was the consul, the Bolivian consul. She enters the consulate pretending to be an Australian tourist, dressed with a wig, with a purse, with a pistol, with a revolver that was given to her by an Italian anarchist publisher called Feltrinelli, and kills the man, and then runs away. Somebody manages to grab her wig, and this is the evidence that I gathered from the Frankfurt police archives, which was found by a friend contact who was helping me do the research. So I began making installations by printing these images in very translucent mylar and then hanging it with braces, with aluminum braces and wires. And so I would make different versions of this suspended photographs. This is another one. The previous one was at the Museo del Barrio. This one is at Museo de Arte Moderno de Buenos Aires. This is what came out on the BBC News very recently, about 3 weeks ago. Hans Ertl, right there. Hans Ertl on the top right-hand side, shooting part of the film Olympia, with Leni Riefenstahl standing next to him. And then Hans Ertl and his family in Bolivia below. Probably the little girl right here is Monica, who grows up as a sympathizer of the left-wing movement. I was telling you about the Alonso painting, in which you see a body with the pants lowered. This is the first column of men that is captured during the Nyankawasu, during the Che Guevara campaign in Bolivia. It's, the leader of this column was called Joaquin. The reports say that they were all killed during the ambush. But then you wonder, if they were killed, why are their hands tied? Why are their pants lowered? Why are their elbows shattered by close-range bullets? I think that they were captured alive and that they were really tortured, mortified, their bodies broken. Some of the, in one case, you see the pants are lowered. They were probably tortured in many different ways. I took this photograph, which was published in one of the vanity books that each of the Bolivian military published after each one claiming that responsibility for capturing Che Guevara. And then I took the image and I plotted the image and I made this this work. And this work is actually, there are very, very economic ways of making large scale works in humble materials, in paper, in photographic paper, or even in regular paper, by blowing up the photograph, plotting it into pages. As you can see, I tilted the image, and yet I tilted the image within a field that in some cases allows me, I even have empty pages in order to tilt the image. And I made this installation, which is very, very striking looking, and it really like grabs you. And then I tell the whole story of the Joaquin column. I would not write anything. I would only gather quotes from different books, including Che Guevara's diaries, including military reports. I would then assemble a chronology of all the events, starting on the pre-guerrilla period, earlier than 1967. In 1963, you begin to hear about different movements forming in the area. And then it goes on after 1967, because many other things related to Che Guevara's campaign in Bolivia happened. And so I would make a kind of like diary on such day. This general writes this report, this newspaper reports this, Che Guevara says this in his diary, this historian says this. And so when you read this very long mural text that is very organized and codified in color so that you know the author and where, and the source is clearly identified, so I would not really invent anything. I would just quote with typing errors, with spelling errors, whatever it was, different ways of spelling certain words, etc. They were present right there as quotes. And so when you would read this mural text, this chronology, it's really, I must have read it hundreds of times, and every time I read it, I see how your how intense it is, because what you realize is how this information and wishful thinking and reality sort of work together. Because in Guevara's diaries, there is the suspicion that what he hears on the radio that he carries is this information. And what he writes is wishful thinking. And what happens later is, you know, the real history. And so when you're reading this contradictory text, it's really like it's so intense and suspenseful to go through the whole chronology that I adopted that manner of doing research and doing work that relates to historical subjects because of the how effective it seems to me. In addition, I did not create any of the images. What I do is I go to those military records and I find badly reproduced images about this size, and then I enhance and blow them up. These are all drawings by a prisoner, Bustos, who is arrested together with a French writer, Regis Debray. An Argentine artist is also arrested. They were trying to make some kind of connection with the guerrilla when they met Guevara, and then they were trying to leave the camp, and the military grabbed them, and they arrest them, and they force this man Bustos to confess, and because they realized he was an artist, they demand that he makes sketches of all the participants. He makes a number of sketches that are really excellent, and a number of sketches that are intended to disorient. And so some of the characters are real, and some of that he draws, and some of the characters are fictional. And he gives them the nicknames, the name of the war names. How do you say the nom de guerre in English?
Nom de guerre.
Nom de guerre. That's easy. And so I made these banners on the Bustos drawings together with, they are actually 12, they are not 17. I decided that I will publish 12. They were like the apostles, you know. And then I would concentrate on the figure of Tanya. Tanya was an extraordinary character also. All the narrative that one can construct around this event, this tragic and yet, it's not an enormous war, it's not an enormous case, it's not, one of the horrible explosions that happen in Europe or in the Far East or in the Near East or in the U.S. It's relatively a small event, and yet it's very significant. I thought that the image of this woman, who was a kind of Mata Hari, a beautiful young German, originally German Jew, who together with her parents moves to Argentina. She's actually Argentinian, Tanya Bauer. She grows up in Argentina and then becomes a communist. She comes from the eastern from East Germany, but they are fleeing anti-Semitism. They go to Argentina. She grows up as a devoted communist, and she begins to visit Cuba and to meet Guevara in a European Congress and a youth congress, and then moves to Cuba and becomes a member of the Cuban community, and also volunteers as a liaison in Bolivia before Guevara arrives, so that she infiltrates the cultural circles, the military circles, the diplomatic circles. She has different names, many passports. It's like, the born identity, It's like, and here you see her in her different hairdos, has a very wonderful mimetic quality about, transforming herself. And it's a very interesting character, and I decided to make a series of installations on her. Each of the installations, as you can see, this is in the Art Institute of Chicago. I use the stretched photographic banners, and I put counterweights. I kind of like force the photograph, which is laminated Cibachromes, sort of like stretch it with turnbuckles and steel wire, and put counterweights on the floor so I don't have to drill the floor, and make them kind of fly like kites on the air. This is a most recent installation in which I made the installation of Tanya making the taking a photograph, and also I decided to leave the very clean stripe with the chronology and let it sort of bleed down to the floor. And this is an installation in Recoleta. I'm using the counterweights and the strapped banners. And on the opposite side, I'm using the newest research, which is called Tanya Masks and Trophies. It all has to do with hidden identities. And so the idea of masks, Che Guevara disguising himself, the whole idea of disguise is important to me. I made an intensive research. Some of it is in the second film that is in Spanish. in another monitor. Perhaps we can place a chair in front of that monitor. It's hard to watch it, but I suggest that if you can understand Spanish, that you see Exhumación after seeing El Día Que Me Quieras, because it's a really extraordinary interview that in Chaurregui, the forensic anthropologist, gives. The mural texts are graphically, they are all large. They are on the website as well. You can see them on the website. I do these mural texts on different subjects. I have one about called Paradox, about the banana industry and the archaeological excavations in the area of the United Fruit Company. I have the one on Guevara's campaign. I have this one called Tanya and the Trophies. And I have another one that is in progress called Vortex, which is about the true, the basis of the novel, the great classical novel, La Vorágine, by José Eustacio Rivera, about the rubber industry at the beginning of the century. It's also about an Irish patriot who denounces the exploitation and murder, mass murder of Huitoto Indians in the Amazon. It's the beginning of the destruction of the Amazon, and it follows the structure of the novel. It's called Vortex. And the mural texts are up online as well. You can see, these are samples of some of the pages. They are very readable online. Some of the mural texts that are online are both in Spanish and in English. And some of them, for now, are in Spanish or in the language that I had conducted the research in. These are, again, the samples of the identities that, you know, I made the installations on during the research in 2007, working through a network. I already have a kind of network of researchers that look for the same things. You know, it's like looking for visible evidence, visual elements. And a man from Brazil sent me this photograph that he had found about finding about the killing of Tanya in one of the ambushes where she falls into the river. They find her knapsack. The knapsack has a camera with the negatives. Her body floats downstream. They find her a couple of days later. And this is a photograph showing how they found her body. These are samples of the photographs that were captured by the military and that were published in all the military journals that the different Bolivian military had published in different presses in Santa Cruz in Bolivia. These are photographs that actually should be in some kind of archive, a national archive, somewhere in Cuba or in Argentina or even in Bolivia, but not in the hands of this military or their heirs, who have created a market of the photographs taken by the fallen, you know. These are different photographs. This photograph in the center is kind of quite extraordinary. It's in the biography by John Lee Anderson, the New York Times, the great New York Times journalist. And I found two different versions of this photograph. And it's interesting because you see Guevara and Tuma. Guevara and Tuma were, Tuma was his bodyguard, and he dressed exactly like Guevara, and he was like a lookalike as protection. It was like, how do you say, a decoy. People speak about the number of watches that Guevara had, two watches, two Rolexes. Actually, one of the Rolexes belonged to Tuma, who was killed in one of the ambushes, and he was carrying them to give them to Tuma's parents. This is the website. For some reason, maybe Aaron can tell me why my graphics sort of like didn't fit exactly. And if Aaron knows how to use Keystone, or perhaps a member of the audience can tell me that. Any questions? I love to talk about this. I have so much to tell you, you realize. Yes, is there a question?
Well, at the beginning of your talk, you were talking about aestheticizing horror.
Yes.
Can you talk a little more about how you resolved that feeling?
No, I regarded it as a banal scruple. I thought that it made more sense to speak about events, historical events, than to avoid them out of some kind of, as I said, banal scruple. I think that one has to be more proactive, and I think that even though I realize I step into an arena that at the time, especially when I would tell people that I was doing something in 1987, which was what, Reagan era? I don't know. It was, they thought I was some kind of deranged old hippie. You know, it's like Che Guevara, I mean, it's like T-shirts, you know, it's like, but no, I'm very serious. I thought that one, which we are familiar, we should become, I am an American. I am more of an American than an Argentine. I have lived two-thirds of my life in New York City, and I understand American culture, and I have taught for many years and in different universities, and I've always been very concerned about this idea that we see so much in the news right now about being an American, as if America was a self-contained planet. You know, it's like I think that we cannot have a double talk, speak about globalization, global economy, the global warming, global this and global that, and at the same time have an attitude that shuts off to the other, to other cultures. And I know that you're probably, most of you, I'm sure, very intelligent and creative, and you understand this, but I think that, you know, we are at a moment in the world's culture in which we have to hear other perspectives. And when I began this film, I was actually rather distant. You know, I didn't expect that I would become emotionally involved. And even though I tried to maintain a kind of journalistic distance, there was a point when I was editing the film that when I was seeing the cadavers on the floor, when I was finding out about the whereabouts of Loro, and when I would call Bolivia and speak with his brother and hear about the agony of the family. And when I would hear different perspectives, I don't recommend anyone to go and start a guerrilla warfare, for God's sake, but I think that we should try to understand the period and the intention that Guevara had, which I think were very, very honorable. Guevara knew, we saw the Motorcycle Diaries, it's perhaps a romanticized idea of of Guevara's quest, but I think there is an element of truth that I think he was sincerely motivated by the poverty that he saw in Bolivia, by the displacement of miners, by the brutal treatment of indigenous communities in his part of the world, and I think that his motives were very honorable. He also knew that Bolivia was filled with Nazi refugees that were controlling the secret police and were part of the repressive years that Chile, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, and Bolivia had to endure. So I think that, you know, we have to be aware of all that. You know, there are all those things that we should know about. And so that was my motivation, you know. But I always try to, you know, I find it interesting that the film may show to Cuban dissidents, and they would have respect for the image of Guevara. I was very impressed by that. When the film was invited to show to premiere in Cuba, I was terrified because I thought that I was committing a kind of sacrilegious act, because the cadaver of Ernesto Che Guevara had not been shown ever to Cuban audiences. And when I show the film, which is only about the cadaver, it's no longer about photograph of the, you know, that we see on the T-shirts, which is a photograph that I do not use, which is a photograph that has become part of, you know, consumer society, which is a beautiful photograph. However, I wanted to concentrate on the photograph of the cadaver, which is a much more disturbing photograph, and which obviously, you know, sort of generates other type of questions about torture, about execution, about killing someone without a trial, about, you know, about other things. The photograph says so many things, you know. It's like the photograph, the amazing thing about the photograph is that, if I could go back to the photograph, let me see if I can do it without Aaron's help. And the amazing thing about the photograph is that it displays. Here it is. It displays the centurions. I mean, look at this photograph and tell me if it was called a Christic photograph. Jorge Castañeda, one of the biographers, calls it Christic. Why is it that I cannot show you the full photograph? Because I don't know how to manipulate this. So, how do you do this? Aaron, what do I do? Play slideshow. Okay, is it? I mean, look, if you look at it without you knowing who in the world this may be, and you see the combination of generals who rush to put their gala uniforms for the photo opportunity and pose in front of a half-dressed man, barefoot, and absolutely, you know, it's like, if you look at this photograph, you say, how could they be so dumb? You know, it's like, because it really, like, the photograph made the myth. He was already a mythological character, but this photograph made him more mythological, because it's a Christic image. Is this the Roman centurions and Christ? Thank you so much.